Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia, this is CJSF 90.1 FM.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded April 12th, 2023. Well, yesterday, the Prime Minister's office announced more support for Ukraine. Good-hearted Canadians concerned about the well-being of that country and its citizens will be disappointed, however, to discover just what support in the parlance of Ottawa's current rulers translates as. In bullet points, it means tens of thousands of weapons, millions of rounds of ammunition, and the unaccountable dispersal of more billions of Canadian dollars to the Kyiv regime. In simpler terms, the Liberal government is guaranteeing more war and more destruction in Ukraine for the months and perhaps years to come, even as it wages a sanctions war against the only party that can stop the war, Russia. Some support. Ken Stonan is an executive member of both the Syria Support Movement International and Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. Ken and the coalition are pleased, they say, to participate this month in kicking off the Canadian tour of sanctions, a wrecking ball in a global economy. Ken Stone in the first half. And if the Ottawa Weathervane Globe and Mail is any indication, its chief political scribe Stephen Chase's recent article headed pro-Kremlin Twitter accounts weaponizing fringe users to erode Canadians' support for Ukraine, study finds, signals a new Canadian understanding of citizenship with an unmistakable McCarthyite tone. John Helmer is a journalist and author who spent decades living in and reporting from Russia, the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears. Helmer has, too, been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism, and served as advisor to governments at the highest levels. Among his many book titles are Skripal in Prison, The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Jackal's Wedding, American Power, Arab Revolt, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, and his latest, Australian Fascism, How It Destroyed the Courts. John Helmer and fighting the Canadian think tanks and troll armies in the war for truth-telling in the second half. But first, Ken Stone and fighting Canada's sanction warriors. Welcome back to the show, Ken.
My pleasure, Chris.
Well, Ken, now the PMO's latest message in my inbox, it hit me in the gut like an ill-advised meal. And just as our annual tax tribute deadline looms as well, it's more for war. Ken, I assume you've read the same PMO message I did.
I did indeed. And it's, as you say, it's sickening that our Canadian taxpayers' money is being flushed down the toilet in Ukraine and on hundreds of billions of dollars worth of arms in general.
I think it would be even better if it was flushed down the toilet, actually. I mean, that how many lives would that save? I mean, the numbers here are incredible. 21,000 assault rifles. And I was trying to think, you know, what Canadian town is around that population? And you imagine the government coming in one day and saying, not even in a time of conflict, just a regular old day, here's 21,000 people, a gun for everybody. I mean, what kind of mayhem do you think might ensue then, you know? And yet here they're doing that in this circumstance and throwing in literally millions of bullets to boot.
Yes, the outcome is not going to be pretty. But the reason that he's doing this is because Justin Trudeau has no independence of foreign policy. He is a vassal of the U.S. He is a willing accomplice of the U.S. empire. And his aim and that of his deputy prime minister, Chrystia Freeland, is to, quote, vanquish Russia on behalf of the United States of America. And they have worked on this since 1991. And the Canadian government spent $1 billion between 1991 and 2014 to arrange for two coups d'etat in Ukraine. The first one was called the Orange Revolution in 2004, and the second one was the Maidan coup in 2014. And since 2014, cooperated completely with NATO and the U.S. to turn the coup government into a de facto NATO government in Ukraine, to turn the army into a de facto NATO army to attack the Russian-speaking people in the east of Ukraine, and to wage war, to start a war, to provoke a war against Russia. So this is all part and parcel of the fact that the Canadian government is a willing servant of the U.S. empire. You will note, please, that our colleague, or Justin Trudeau's colleague south of the U.S. border, Mr. Obrador, his government does not belong to NATO. It is not buying F-35 fighter jets. It is not sending any arms to Ukraine. And in fact, it accused the U.S. of fomenting the problem in Ukraine. So why is it that we are such slaves to the U.S. when our partners in the U.S. MCA, the Free Trade Agreement, aren't likewise tied to the empire the way we are?
Well, AMLO down there in Mexico, too, his term is almost up. I think he's going out the door, for one thing. So maybe he feels he can afford to say that. But his comments about Ukraine have elicited a pretty violent reaction from both America and Canada. I was reading something about that earlier in the week, that he's being roundly vilified. And I even heard a little balloon. I think I heard a balloon floating up about a possible military invasion to do a regime change in Mexico. Is that right?
You are right. There was a trial balloon about that. And I mean, what's going on in the U.S. right now is getting crazier and crazier and more disconnected and more disintegrated than I've ever seen in my lifetime. I don't know how that's going to end, but it looks like the U.S. government and the powers that be are pushing down on the gas pedal and heading straight for the wall. And in fact, they have sabotaged their own economic interests around the world by waging an economic war, not only the military war in Ukraine, which they are going to lose shortly, in my personal opinion, but they waged an economic war against Russia, which backfired. What it did was remove cheap Russian gas from the European market. Of course, the U.S. also, in my opinion, blew up the Nord Stream pipeline so that there was no possibility of restoring that gas flow. And then that caused a tremendous inflation in the West, and it forced the countries that were being sanctioned, namely Russia and China, and their partners around the world, including Brazil, India, South Africa, the BRICS countries, to establish an alternate means of transferring money to the U.S. SWIFT system, and to create a new currency called, we don't know what it's going to be called, but Dilma Rousseff, the former president of Brazil, has just been installed as the new head of the bank of the BRICS, which is going to establish a new currency for the world. So the U.S. dollar is no longer going to be the king of the world. And the only people who brought this on was Biden himself, by fomenting, and his predecessors, of course, fomenting this war against the Russian Federation.
Well, even if, let's call it a BRIC then, the BRIC dollar, even without that, even if it takes a couple of years to formalize, already countries like Saudi Arabia, a devoted ally of the West up until recently, has already cut deals with China to sell petrol products in exchange for yuan, the Chinese currency. That is the key, that underpinning of the petrodollar that the American fiat dollar is based and has been based since, Nixon's time.
Absolutely. The Chinese pulled off a tremendous coup, brokering a peace agreement, not a peace agreement, but a rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran, whereby they restored diplomatic relations. This was done apparently without even the knowledge of the U.S., and it has changed the picture of the world dramatically. For example, it now appears that there is an end in sight. There is light at the end of the tunnel, though I don't know how long the tunnel is actually going to be for the wars in Yemen, for the people of Yemen to live in peace again, and for the people of Syria once again to be accepted into the international community. Right now, the Saudi representatives are meeting with representatives of the Ansar Allah movement in Sana'a, and they are talking about, they say, before the end of Ramadan, Muslim holy month, which I think goes for another 2 weeks, they are going to renew the truce, which had expired last October, and they are hoping to make the truce permanent shortly following that. It was China that brokered that, and they did it by providing a win-win situation through the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, which is another name is the New Silk Road that the Chinese are pushing around the world, which is a means of economic cooperation and trade across the middle of the globe. And Yemen is right on it, and the Yemenis are dying. The Yemenis are very eager to become part of that BRI, and the Chinese also decided to co-sponsor the Saudi project, which they call NEOM, which is a high-tech installation in Saudi Arabia to link Saudi Arabia and Egypt and other countries in the Middle East. So it's a win-win situation that China brokered, and I think it's part of the big change in the balance of power in the world, where previously we've talked many times, you and I, Chris, about the U.S. wanting to remain the sole superpower in a unipolar world, but that has now changed, and we seem to be living in a multipolar world now, although the U.S. and Canada don't seem to want to recognize that fact, and they are embarking on foolhardy and reckless projects all over the world, but especially, two places especially dangerous. One is Ukraine, and the other one that seems to be heating up very quickly is Taiwan.
There's also a move to mend fences with Syria, a place that I know that you're really interested in as well. And we're going to get to that in a second, Ken. But one of the things about China, when you were mentioning that their middleman deal between Iran and the Saudis went without the United States actually knowing, they were taken totally by surprise. I saw a tweet from the CIA director, William Burns, who churlishly says, Russia is becoming increasingly dependent on Beijing. And in some respects, he warns, they risk becoming an economic colony of China over time. Now, it's pretty heartwarming to see the CIA so concerned about the Russian economy like this and warning off warning Moscow off of becoming, embroiled with the dastardly Chinese communists. But reading that, it actually said, like most of the things that I see coming from the United States, it sounded to me just like pure projection. It's actually America that has worried about becoming an economic colony over time, and that time has come very quickly with over these last 20 or 30 years or so. American industry and the corporate world all branch planting itself over to Asia and taking advantage of the lower wages and environmental standards, et cetera, over there, that has really hollowed out the American economy. And for them, I think it's all for what Mr. Burns is warning Russia of has already happened largely in the United States.
Yes, and they are the victims of their own greed. In your words, hollowed out their own economies to ship all their industry over to China and other parts of Asia. And now they are left without any basic industries except one, and that is the armaments industry, which is probably their main support and their main means of employing people. And they've diversified it cleverly so that there's some in every congressional district and senatorship, Senate district, there's some kind of war plant, so that it makes it very difficult for any politicians in the U.S. to get up and say, we don't need these war industries. We shouldn't have these war industries. They're costing us too much. And we don't have an industrial base anymore to build prosperity for U.S. citizens. So they're afraid, they're afraid of saying that, these politicians, because of offending working people in their own districts whose jobs depend on the war economy.
You mentioned, Ken, the history of Canada's involvement in Ukraine. In this PMO release, just put out that we ostensibly began with, the Canadian PMO's office only goes so far as recognizing the history beginning with 2015 and the so-called Operation Unifier, where they boast or crow unashamedly that the country has paid, our country has paid for the training of more than 36,000 members of, quote, Ukraine's security forces. What do those security forces look like, Ken? What are they constituted from, rather?
They are constituted by, in many cases, militias that are extremely right-wing. And when I mean extremely right-wing, I mean neo-Nazi. These are the descendants, the direct descendants of the units, such as the Waffen-SS and the Banderites, who allied themselves with Hitler during World War II to fight the Soviet Union. And even after World War II, these Banderites continued their war against the Soviet Union in the Ukraine and in Poland, and they killed tens of thousands of Poles and Jews and Russians. So these are the people like the Azov Battalion and many other, there were something like 40 militia units like the Azov Battalion that were incorporated into the new Ukrainian army, which the Canadian government funded and trained under Project Unifier. And they even trained some of these neo-Nazi units, such as the Azov Battalion. That came out in a news story in Canada about 18 months ago. I think the Ottawa Citizen, David Pugliese, was the one who broke the story. And it turned out the Canadian government wasn't concerned about training neo-Nazis, whom our grandfathers and our fathers fought and died fighting against in World War II, lest we forget. But the Canadian government was concerned that the Canadian people might find out about this and get angry about it. That was the concern of the Canadian government at the time. So now we are in a position where the Canadian government is supporting this army, riddled with openly neo-Nazi elements, and a government that celebrates the birthday of Stepan Bandera every January the 1st with torchlight parades, and has been building monuments to collaborators who fought with Hitler, Ukrainian collaborators who fought with Hitler during World War II, and tearing down the statues of Russian heroes and Ukrainian heroes who fought against the Nazis. So we are supporting with $8 billion so far in military aid and in funding to the Ukrainian government. That's $8 billion. Imagine what those $8 billion could do to achieve an end to homelessness in Canada, or what that $8 billion could do to resolve the issue of drinking water and housing for people on First Nations reserves. But no, instead, it's gone to Ukraine. And even though the Russians have been trying to make peace agreements on two, at least three occasions now, the first time shortly after the war started, a second time when Naftali Bennett, the Israeli prime minister at the time, wanted to broker a deal. The first deal was brokered by Erdogan of Turkey. The second one was offered by Bennett, rejected by the states. And now there is a third peace plan for Ukraine, which the Russians have put forward. And it was revealed by Dmitry Leskaris, who is a Canadian politician and lawyer and activist and journalist. And he's in Moscow now, and it's a 7-point program. And the U.S. does not want to talk about it. Previous to the Russian peace proposal, they were encouraging China to act as a mediator and bring the Russians to the negotiating table. So the Chinese issued a 12-point peace plan, which is very good. And then the Russians issued this plan, the seven. Well, not openly, I think, but Dmitry got a hold of it. Now the American government says it's not interested at this time in any peace deal. They're waiting for their Ukrainian proxy army to stage a counteroffensive, and they laughably think that they're going to dislodge the Russians from all the territory they've taken in the Donbass in the past year, and from Crimea as well. But it's not going to happen. The Americans, and that looks like Canada too, is using up our tax money to fight to the very last Ukrainian.
Well, they've got their hands on the money, that's for sure. Well, as well as the 21,000 assault rifles, 38 machine guns, that's kind of a funny number, 2.4 million rounds of ammunition donated. Then over the last year, Canada says in this same PMO release that it has committed our taxpayer money. I'll keep repeating as you go down to the craw to donate or be thrown in jail. $1 billion in military assistance to Ukraine, 8 Leopard 2 main battle tanks promised, an armored recovery vehicle, the National Advanced Surface-to-Air Missile System, the NASAMS, that we, Canada, as I recall, bought without even opening the box for $460-something million, as I recall, from the United States or one of their weapons providers, and then sent, still in its wrappings, to the government over there. 39 armored combat support vehicles, anti-tank weapons, small arms, of course, M777 howitzers and associated ammunition, high-resolution drone cameras, winter clothing, and more, it says, including assault rifles to be, or sniper rifles, I'm sure, to be used as they were by the Americans to shoot civilians from miles away in Iraq. Well,
don't forget the $2.4 billion loan that the Canadian government just gave to the Ukrainian government that will never get paid back.
No.
And don't forget that Canada has repatriated in 2022 136,000 Ukrainian refugees. And this year is planning to bring in 440,000 more Ukrainian refugees. Imagine the cost of resettling and relocating these people, even finding housing for these people. The cost of this war to Canada are going to be astronomical.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Ken Stone. Ken is an executive member of both the Syria Support Movement International and Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. And we haven't got to it yet, Ken, but Ken and the coalition are pleased. They say to be participating in this month is launch of the Canadian book tour of Sanctions, A Wrecking Ball in a Global Economy. You touched a little bit, Ken, on the sanctions already. It's alien, and I did in the introduction, that the sanctions that this country, Canada, has against Russia, we've alienated ourselves from them. Really, there's no hope that Canada could provide any mediation or anything. We're viewed as just being a satrapy of the United States, and rightly so, I would venture. Tell me, Ken, about this book, though, and about the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War's involvement in it and efforts in promoting it.
So we're having a Canadian book tour, book launch tour of the book, Sanctions, a Wrecking Ball in the Global Economy, which is about 100 and little under 200 page book. It's a compendium of articles about sanctions and their nasty effect on people in one-third of the world. One-third of the people of the world are living under U.S., Canadian, and EU sanctions. And you may ask, what are these sanctions? Well, the word sanctions is actually a misnomer. They're actually they're called coercive economic measures, and they involve preventing trade and preventing supplies of spare parts, medication, books, screws, and especially financial transactions. 42 countries of the world, mostly in the global south, mostly poor countries in the global south, countries which are composed of mostly non-white people. And none of the countries are allies or friends of the U.S. and Canadian governments. For example, the reason for these sanctions are usually given as these countries are committing human rights violations and so forth. But countries like Saudi Arabia, which has the most dismal human rights record in the entire world, or Israel, which routinely beats up on its Palestinian citizens and is doing it right now at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, they never get any sanctions. So what are sanctions? What are these coercive economic measures? They are, in fact, an act of war. And the United Nations Charter recognizes them as such and reserves to the UN Security Council, the only body in the world, the power to issue sanctions, economic sanctions or coercive economic measures against countries as a tool of diplomatic policy. And the UN has sanctioned about 10 countries in the world. But on top of that, Canada, the US, and the EU sanctioned about another 30. And these sanctions that Canada, the US, and the EU level against these countries, mostly in the third world of non-white people, are illegal because they have not got the approval of the UN Security Council. And, you know, they're sold in the West, these coercive economic measures, as a less violent means of bringing certain recalcitrant nations, states, into compliance with our foreign policy. We get to set the bar, and we use these coercive economic measures to try and influence these countries to go along the path that we want them to go along. But in fact, these coercive economic measures are really part of economic warfare against these countries. And if you want to go a bigger, broader picture, they are part of a scheme of hybrid warfare, which includes economic sanctions, legal sanctions, demonization, lawfare, and actually proxy wars. They all fit into the scheme of hybrid warfare. And they are used against countries and have been used against countries. And contrary to the idea that these measures are softer, less violent means of influencing other countries, they actually kill more people than bullets. We've talked before, you and I, Chris, about the classic case in Iraq between the two Gulf Wars when U.S. sanctions on Iraq killed 500,000 children who were denied adequate food and medications. And when she was interviewed about it, this former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright said it was worth it. It was worth the killing 500,000 kids through these coercive economic measures in order to bring down Iraq, the Iraqi government, which we know was done in 2003 by Bush and Blair in an illegal war which hadn't got the approval of the UN Security Council. So that's the classic example. But people are dying today in Syria, People are dying today in Yemen. People are dying in Zimbabwe. People are dying in Venezuela.